The Life of General Belisarius, Italy After Belisarius, Part 2. Now, when Narses had been under Belisarius in the earlier Italian campaigns, we saw that he was in the most disadvantaged colors, careless in public interest, struggled against legitimate authority, and always ready to hinder the prosecution of the war through private jealousies and cabals. But by an unusual transition, the turbulent subaltern had become a skillful, judicious, and discerning general, and ever since he held the supreme command, had diligently recommended and enforced the duties of subordination. As soon as his arrangements were completed, he led his troops to Salona, and from there he headed to the Adriatic Gulf, in order to avoid the Franks, who during the distracted state of Italy had usurped several of its northern districts. Narses marched along the morass and the lagoons of the Venetian shore. He reached Ravenna without hindrance, and allowed 9 days for the refreshment of his troops. In his further progress, some molestation was experienced from the garrison at Rimini, which had cut through the stately marble bridge constructed by Augustus, and still remaining to attest its munificence. But Narses effected a passage higher up the stream, and avoiding the fortress of Petra Petrugia, diverged into the mountains on his right and rejoined the Flaminian road a few miles below the dangerous defile. Confiding in his superior force, and doubtful how long he might be able to control and unite the jarring elements of which it was composed, Narses postponed the siege of cities and was anxious to avail himself of his advantage in a pitched and decisive battle. On the other hand, the martial and impetuous spirit of Totila rendered him no less impatient for a prompt conclusion of the war. June A.D. 552, and having mustered all of his troops at Rome, he led them by hasty marches against the Byzantines. The two armies came in presence in the field of Tagina, near the modern town of Gualdo, a level space surrounded on almost every side by rugged heights of the Apennine Mountains. This spot had already been rendered famous by the defeat of the Gauls, and seemed to present an inauspicious augury to the barbarians. Totila was not dismayed by the formidable aspects of the hostile army, and haughtily dismissed the envoys of Narses, who represented the folly of attempting to contend with such overwhelming numbers, and urged him to anticipate defeat by capitulation. "On the 8th day, said the wily monarch, we will meet in battle." But these words did not deceive his vigilant antagonist, and when the next morning he suddenly drew out his troops in array, he found the Byzantines fully prepared for engagement. Under these circumstances, the onset was delayed by the barbarian until 2,000 Goths, his last reinforcements, should arrive, and he availed himself of the interval to display before both armies his personal activity and strength. Gold shone upon his armor, royal purple was conspicuous in a streamer from his spear, and his spirited steed was made to prance and curvet in the most skillful evolutions. He hurried his lance into the air, he caught it in its fall. He threw himself backwards on his saddle and suddenly recovered his seat. And in short, the observers, admiring it greatly, it was apparent that from the youngest youth he had been well instructed in the art of dancing. Meanwhile, the Byzantine general rode along the line, exhorting his troops to overwhelm the scanty battalions of the Goths, and displaying golden bracelets, collars, and other precious trappings as the destined rewards of valor. It was late in the afternoon before Totila received his expected assistance, and having then exchanged his glittering cuirass for some less splendid and conspicuous armor, he gave the signal for battle. The engagement was short but decisive. A headlong charge of the Gothic horsemen was steadfastly encountered by the Byzantine line, and they were then hit in the flank by distant volleys of arrows, while lance and their only weapon could neither avert nor retaliate this attack. They were driven back in confusion and dismay, and pressing against the Gothic infantry, broke its ranks and involved it in their flight. The runaways were pursued in all directions by the relentless Byzantines. No quarter was given, and the loss of the barbarians on this occasion exceeded 6,000 men. Protected by the approach of night, Totila had fled from the field, followed by only 5 men in his train. He was overtaken by some Byzantine soldiers headed by Asbad of the tribe of the Gepi. They were yet ignorant of the importance of their prize. The dangerous secret was revealed by the inconsiderate exclamation of a Goth, "Do you dare to strike the king?" And Asbad, instructed by these words, raised his lance and pierced Totila with a mortal wound, a blow which he himself immediately received from a brave barbarian. This enabled him, when further conflict and pursuit, His soldiers remained in attendance on their chief, and the Goths bore off their prince at full speed, in spite of the anguish which he suffered such speed of movement. After a progress of 12 miles, they halted at the village of Capra. The expiring monarch was lifted from his horse, and the fidelity of his subjects soothed his last moments. But the humble tomb to which the pious care consigned him was, a few hours later, revealed by Gothic treachery and rifled by Byzantine curiosity and avarice. The remains of Totila were exposed to an exulting gaze of the soldiery, while his bloody garments and his hat, adorned with jewels, were dispatched as trophies of victory to the emperor and laid before his throne at a solemn meeting of his court. Such, after reigning 11 years, was the end of Totila, a prince whose death left his countrymen in almost as desperate a condition as he found them on his first accession. From the fields of Tegina, Narses now pursued his march towards the capital. Nor could the towns of Spoleto and Narna, which Totila had dismantled, offer any obstacle to his progress. The Eternal City yielded to his first assault. The Gothic garrison, entrenching itself in the mole of the Hadrian's tomb, protracted its resistance a few days longer. But Narses was enabled to send once more to Justinian the keys of Rome, which had been taken and retaken 5 times in less than 20 years. Each successive capture had been impressive to the people, but this last was fatal to the Senate. The barbarian confederates in the Byzantine army never failed to represent the wealthy as traitors to the emperor, and often committed murder as an excuse for robbery. While on the other hand, the senators in Sicily, who had begun to hasten homewards, were intercepted in Campania by the despair and the vengeance of the Goths, and 300 high-born hostages from Rome were butchered to the northward of the river Po. The death of so many nobles appears to have occasioned the downfall and the end of their order in the state, and thus almost the same, though from very different causes. Beheld, the Roman Senate and the Roman consulship were extinguished. From this time forward, till the new institutions, by Arnold of Brescia in the 12th century, the annals of history seldom contain the words of consul or senator, and even then these are classic titles that are only used for count or seigneur. After the death of Totila, as after the captive of Vitiges, the surviving remnant of the Goths assembled within the ramparts of Pavia, where Tius, one of the principal officers, was unanimously proclaimed king. That the new monarch was worthy of the throne may be presumed from his accepting it so readily, at a moment when it only promised a career of peril, toil, and probable destruction. On learning that the troops of Narses had invested Cumae, he resolved without delay to relieve this important fortress, which was defended by his brother, Allergan, and contained the greater part of the treasures of Totila. Putting himself, therefore, at the head of the slender forces, he advanced by hasty marches into southern Italy. This would be in 553 AD. He eluded the Byzantine detachment stationed to arrest his progress and arrived in safety at the foot of Mount Vesuvius. Here he entrenched himself along the river called Sarnus by the ancient Romans and Draco in the Middle Ages, in which at present has again reverted to the name of Sarno. The opposite bank of the stream was occupied by Narses for 2 whole months. These armies continued in presence, apparently desirous of exhausting each other's patience, and only engaged by occasional single combat or distant skirmishes of archers. At the end of this period, the fleet of Tessus, on which he depended for sustenance of his troops, deserted to the Byzantines, and the barbarians were struck with consternation, fled from their advantageous position towards the neighboring mountain of Laertes. On this commanding height, the Goths might secure from attack, but not from famine. And instead of awaiting its lingering tortures, they resolved to meet a prompt and glorious death in battle. Descending, therefore, into the plain, they dismissed their horses, by no means of escape might allure them from their purpose, and charged the Byzantine army without a hope of victory. With all courage of despair, hitherto the Goths' monarch had displayed the skill as a chief. He now was remarkable for his personal prowess as a soldier. Conspicuous in the van of his little army, he expected and parried the blows which were aimed from every quarter at so important a mark, while his weighty lance seldom failed in transfixing his assailants. Neither danger nor fatigue could move him from his station, and he seemed, says Procopius, as if he was rooted into the ground. At length, when calling on his arm-bearer for a fresh buckler, and lay aside his own, encumbered by the weight of 12 hostile javelins, his breast, uncovered by this incautious moment, was struck with a mortal blow. His severed head was raised on a spear by the troops of Narses, but the barbarians were rather animated than disheartened by the example of their leader. They continued the engagement until night. They renewed it on the ensuing day, with their strength weakened, but their spirit unimpaired. It was only when darkness again divided the combatants that the few survivors proposed, and Narses accepted, a capitulation. It was agreed that the remaining Goths should either wander forth from Italy or live in future the peaceful, loyal subjects of Justinian. Still, however, in spite of this treaty, Allergan, nestled in the lofty rock of Cumae, continued to hold out, and the Byzantine general was compelled to employ the most protracted and laborious expedients against him. The Sibyl's Grotto, no doubt the same which now returned to its original size, is displayed to inquiring travelers by Italian antiquarians, was scooped and widened to an enormous cavern, and drew down in its fall a rampart and the gate of Cumae which surmounted it. Yet the undaunted Goth still managed the summit of the crumbling precipice, nor was it till he perceived the entire dispersion of his countrymen and the hopelessness of his cause that he considered and consented to surrender. He was received with all the courtesy and respect which so high-minded an enemy deserved, forthwith appointed to an honorable post in the Byzantine army. With this capitulation, the Gothic War may be considered as ended, and the Gothic name was altogether extinguished. It is true that an embassy which Tessius had previously dispatched to the Franks and the Alemanni obtained from them a promise of assistance, and that the next autumn a large horde of these barbarians descended from the Alps, but arrived too late. Defeat had thinned, and immigration scattered the Goths. They no longer could claim any political importance, and were a pretext rather than a party to the ensuing war. Having thus brought their monarchy to its final overthrow, it's time to bid farewell to Italian history, and go and see what happened to Belisarius back in Constantinople. The sources for this include The Wars of Justinian by Procopius, Short History of Byzantium by Norwich, Byzantine Art of War by Decker, Byzantine Armies 324 to 1453 by Turnbull, and The Life of Belisarius by Mahone. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.